From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Ron DeSantis has some definite thoughts about a fellow governor who's the Democratic pick for vice president.
Basically, an Ilhan Omar-style, very leftist Democrat from Minnesota has the most liberal record of any governor in the country.
Also this week, with so much fake news abounding, at least one media organization says it can help voters separate fact from fiction.
That's our job. That's where we come in, to kind of be the referee and explain, like, what's real.
We'll also look back at the first hurricane of the season to hit Florida, and we'll get the latest on the search for a university president, which is just one of several challenges facing Florida's preeminent HBCU. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Governor Ron DeSantis is making the media rounds blasting presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris's VP pick, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Tristan Wood reports that feud stems from Walz's frequent criticism of Florida's governor.
DeSantis said during a Tuesday press conference that Walz wasn't tough enough on the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests in Minneapolis, following the death of George Floyd by law enforcement.
Tim Walz, as governor, sat back and let happen. He sat back and let the city of Minneapolis burn. That city has been gutted as a result of those riots. We would never allow that to happen in the state of Florida. So this is a ticket that really represents the spirit of those 2020 BLM riots.
The demonstrations resulted in more than $100 million in damages. Walz delayed deploying the National Guard. He said at the time that he was concerned an armed presence would increase tension. However, the situation is more nuanced. At the time of the protests, Republican responses to Walz were mixed. Audio First reported by ABC News has former President Donald Trump and current GOP nominee praising Walz for his decision to call in the National Guard during a 2020 conference call with U.S. governors.
I know Governor Walz is on the phone and we spoke, and I fully agree with the way he handled it the last couple of days. I asked him to do that.
The dislike between DeSantis and Walz is mutual. Walz has historically been critical of DeSantis and Florida's Republican-controlled government.
I'm only the governor of this great state. It's not up to me how folks in those places, folks like Florida, go about their business. But I got to tell you, I'm pretty glad we do it our way here and not that way.
Walz mentioned Florida in his 2023 State of the State address, contrasting his state passing free breakfast and lunch for school children with Florida's direction on education.
If you need any examples to maybe change your mind on this one, they're banning books in their schools. We're banishing hunger from ours.
DeSantis didn't just make a one-off comment. He continued attacking the Harris-Walz ticket during a conversation with Fox News' Sean Hannity.
You have a vapid San Francisco Democrat leading the ticket, and now they put in this guy Walz, who's basically an Ilhan Omar-style, very leftist Democrat from Minnesota, has the most liberal record of any governor in the country. Is that what the American people want? The San Francisco experience, where homeless are defecating in public on the sidewalks? The Minnesota experience, where cities are burning down?
DeSantis' attacks come as the Harris-Walz ticket appears to be closing in on the Trump-Vance ticket nationally. Recent polling from PBS News, NPR, and Marist shows Harris with a 3-point national lead over the Republican ticket. That's a statistical tie within the margin of error, but it is a significant improvement from where President Joe Biden was polling just a few weeks ago. I'm Tristan Wood.
As campaign season heats up, voters are being inundated with information, misinformation, and disinformation about candidates and issues. That's where PolitiFact Editor-in-Chief Katie Sanders comes in. Sanders and her fact-checking team use a truthometer to help ensure you're getting the truth on social media and in the news. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast from the News Service of Florida, Katie talks about the work PolitiFact is doing to fact-check Vice President Kamala Harris, former President Donald Trump, and information about Project 2025. Here's an excerpt.
To demonstrate that we are still committed to fact-checking the politicians, we have a new presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, has entered the race. So all of a sudden, you're seeing we're paying a lot more attention to what she's saying on the campaign trail, what her social media accounts are claiming about her record and her opponent. Mm-hmm. And one example is she's really trying to tie former President Trump to Project 2025.
Right. Which is not right. A lot of my friends are, you know, who are not in the process are asking me about Project 2025. They're like freaking out about it.
And I think the important thing to say, which is often what Harris is conflating on the trail strategically, is that Trump has not signed on to this plan. It's a 900-page document that's basically a wish list from a number of conservative groups, chief among them the Heritage Foundation. But it's basically a wish list for the next Republican presidential administration. It's like a transition plan. Mm-hmm. Like, here you go. We've done the hard work. Here are names. Here are strategies. Here are policies to go after. Trump has distanced himself from this project, but you still have claims from Harris and others that are kind of tying him to it and misrepresenting what the plan would do. So as an example, there's been a claim that this would end Social Security and end disability benefits. And those sound so extreme, but it's not in the plan.
Okay.
But it works on the campaign trail, so they hope, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of spin going on about Project 2025. Though there are some things it would do that Trump has said he would do, such as closing the Department of Education and reassigning its duties. That's where Project 2025 and Donald Trump's positions align. But it's really hard for voters because who has the time to sift through a 900-page document and then try to make sense of either a website from the Harris campaign making all these claims, Trump, you know, denying it? That's our job. That's where we come in to kind of be the referee and explain, like, what's real.
In general, how truthy is Kamala Harris?
We've fact-checked her 50 times so far, just about. So I think we're going to see that go up exponentially in the coming weeks as we screen her background and claims about it. I did want to add, as an example of the kind of thing we cover nowadays, so we cover Kamala Harris talking about Project 2025. We also cover the online dialogue. And one text post from Facebook that's really in my mind was a claim that said, "By the way, y'all, Project 2025 would end OSHA, basically end workplace protections."
Hmm.
And that's such an alarming claim. And you're a passive social media user. You're scrolling. You see someone you trust or a celebrity you trust making that kind of claim. Are you going to stop what you're doing and do a Google search? Fact checkers wish you would.
Right.
Fact checkers wish it wasn't on there in the first place. But that's the kind of claim that gets surfaced to us through our partnership with Meta. And there's no validity to that claim. But there's a lot of fear-mongering going on.
That was PolitiFact Editor-in-Chief Katie Sanders on the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast. You can hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up on Capitol Report, the season's first hurricane to strike Florida comes ashore in the state's Big Bend region, although its impacts were felt much further afield.
Their stuff got blown around. There's a tree on the house around the corner. Took the whole house out.
Amidst a cornucopia of challenges, Florida A&M University begins the search for a new permanent leader.
There were several communication and internal control failures.
And if you think your job is hot this summer, try working in a food truck.
So when you get done with that and you didn't crash and you didn't die, you're like, wow, all right, okay.
Florida had the season's first visit from a hurricane this week. Tropical Storm Debbie grew into a Category 1 hurricane as it skimmed Florida's Gulf Coast. It came ashore in rural Taylor County in North Florida's eastern Big Bend early Monday. First, a deluge hit parts of southwest and western central Florida. Sarasota declared a state of emergency Sunday as floodwaters closed off streets near popular beach destinations and parts of downtown. As WUSF's Carrie Sheridan reports, many drivers got stranded in the floodwaters.
The high tide and storm surge combined with heavy rain to close off most coastal roads in Sarasota, but also parts of Main Street, the tourist area of St. Armand Circle, and large sections of Tamiami Trail.
Oh, that whole front end of that car is ripped off.
Driving in a pickup truck with a friend, A.J. Grunvig posted a video online showing a sedan trapped in floodwaters on Manasota Beach Road in Englewood, south of Sarasota.
Can't believe the amount of cars that were actually trying to go through that flooded water over there that were actually getting stranded. So we ended up having to stop and help a couple people get out.
Florida's emergency management chief Kevin Guthrie says it's never safe to drive through a flooded street.
Not only can it cause accidental drowning, but floodwaters are gross and unsafe and can contain many hazards.
Take caution if you're heading out. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
Debbie is blamed for at least four deaths in Florida and more in other states. The storm's impact on the Big Bend area east of Tallahassee was largely down trees and power outages, although some residents were severely affected. The WFSU news team talked about it on our new show, Speaking Of, with host Gina Jordan.
So we had a pretty easy time of it here in Tallahassee, but our eastern neighbors are still cleaning up. And I'm joined by WFSU Assistant News Director Regan McCarthy and WFSU reporter Adrian Andrews. Hello.
Hey, Gina. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for talking about this. So Debbie landed near Steinhatchee in Taylor County. That happened Monday morning just before 7. It was not a huge storm. We're getting used to major storms, but this one seemed not so significant unless, of course, you were directly impacted by it. So you two both visited some places that were impacted. And Regan, I want to ask you, one of the things we noticed was there were a lot of power outages, and in particular, Jefferson County, like the whole county was out of power for a couple of days. And that seems strange that not a single place had power. So let's start with you talking about what you saw there.
Sure. I went to Jefferson County to just sort of get a lay of the land and talk to some of the folks there about what their experience was during the storm. And yes, just driving through there, it was very clear. Businesses were closed. Many generators were rumbling, you know, lots of people sitting out on their porch trying to keep cool. I think that's really a big concern following a storm like this. We've got high temperatures coming here, and people without power don't have any way to cool down their homes. But I spoke to one woman there in Monticello who talked about her experience during the storm and talked about the experience at night after the sun went down and what that was like to be in a place with no power as far as she could see in the city.
It's pitch black at night now. Very quiet, except for the guy's generator down there. I think he trumps both of ours. We have one running on this side of the house that runs the downstairs. We got one baby one upstairs on the porch that runs a light, a fan, and the bathroom so we can see.
That was Michelle Bouchard, who, again, I spoke with in Monticello.
And there was damage, a lot of falling trees. And you saw some of the damage that most of us in Tallahassee didn't even realize had happened because it didn't come our way.
That's right. I spoke with the Monticello city manager, Seth Lawless, who as soon as the storm ended had hopped in his car and was really driving around the area. He said several trees throughout the city had fallen, roads were blocked, and there were a few areas that he called major damage. By the time I arrived in Monticello, a lot of those roads had been cleared, but I did again speak with Michelle, who talked to me about her experience during the storm. She said at first she didn't think it was going to be that big a deal, and then the wind really started blowing.
It didn't start off like it wasn't going to be anything, but then the trees started these ones started whipping, and they started ripping out of the ground, and the rain started coming down harder. They had the power lines get taken down. Street lamp hit. It landed on my truck. It hit my car. Yes, we didn't lose our roof, but the building across the road lost a piece of their roof. Their stuff got blown around. There's a tree on the house around the corner, took the whole house out.
So in general, how did it look over there compared to what we've gotten used to with hurricanes?
I think that it really looked like the Monticello area had taken you know, a pretty significant hit. There weren't the sort of piles of debris that we've seen in Tallahassee sometimes, like after Hermine or even after these tornadoes that we had in our area. But a lot of people were still doing that cleanup work. I think those debris piles are going to be getting higher. People seemed in pretty high spirits. Of course, one of the biggest problems they're dealing with is, as I said, that power outage, figuring out how to stay cool. And it seemed like people were really coming together. Michelle, you know, had hooked up a generator to her washing machine and was doing laundry for her neighbors so that they would have clean clothes and hanging those out on the line to dry. I saw another family who had made a DIY slip and slide, and neighborhood kids were all coming over there to stay cool. A lot of people having barbecues. So I think it's really a situation where people are just trying to make the best of it and hoping, you know, lots of line trucks were in the streets, lots of work was going on, and I think they're hoping to get that power back as soon as possible.
Yeah, I love that. Neighbors helping neighbors. That was nice.
Definitely.
Nice to hear. Yeah. Adrian, you went over to Taylor and Madison counties, right?
Correct.
And so those areas were hit hard almost a year ago by major Hurricane Idalia. And now we've got people that I can't even imagine the fear. Like after going through that a year ago, and now here comes another one. And you talked to some people who actually went through both, right?
Correct. Right. Yeah. So I was in Taylor County and just talking to the people there, they're like, well, we can rest a little bit easier tonight. Right. And not only because the storm has gone, it's just the fact that it's not as severe as what it was last year. Right. You had Hurricane Idalia, who came in as a Category 3. This was less severe. You know, it came in as a 1. And I think the biggest problem with Taylor County as right now is power outages. You had flooding as well, and that was a main concern for Stephanie Moore, who actually was coming over from Jacksonville.
Once the storm passed us and the tide started rolling out, it pulled the water out. It receded pretty quickly. But there were roads we couldn't go down because they were too underwater.
So Stephanie came over for a little vacation?
Correct. Yeah, she came over for a vacation, and she was right there in the middle of the storm there. And yeah, so she's coming over, and she's saying, like, well, the water was flooded at the time, right? The water was so high where the streets and the roads, you couldn't even see the bottom, right? So now you have it, whereas 24 hours later, it's all but basically went down.
Yeah, nice. So how did everything look to you? Obviously, I would think it would be very different after this one than after Idalia.
Correct. So you have some few downed trees, but the crews are working. They're getting that stuff out of there, getting the debris up. The water levels, like I said, has definitely went down. So as of right now, like I said, it's power outages. What we're seeing as far as damage is really not that bad. You have some, you know, the working crews out there and everything. But as far as the damage, you have homes that still sort of, you know, with the boarded up and the sandbags are still out, obviously. Not all businesses have begun, you know, they're not back up and operating right now. But no major communities or areas, you know, that really got a lot of damage, right? It's very minor.
Yeah. So for both of you, what would the takeaway be with Debbie compared to what you've seen when you've gone out to cover previous storms? Regan?
I was in the Perry area last year after Hurricane Idalia came, and I think the damage that I saw there was much more significant than it seems like the damage that we're seeing this time around. Of course, big difference in the strength of those storms. And so I think that, again, damage, you know, you don't know exactly what each storm is going to be, what kind of damage it might have, whose house it might come to. And so I think making those preparations, being ready, that's just what we have to get used to as hurricane season continues.
Yeah.
Yeah, Regan, I was there in Perry as well. And like you said, this is not the same. But I will say, just a take from that, I believe these communities have learned sort of to respect hurricanes, right? It's obviously as you move on, you rebuild, you restore. But I think Hurricane Idalia definitely set these communities up to where they're like, okay, we know a storm is coming. Let's work to, we have to set up our wall, and we're going to definitely try to do what we can. You know, I think they definitely did that this time.
Yeah. And again, Gina, as you said, I think that idea of neighbors helping neighbors is something I see every time that I go out and cover a storm. And it's something that I think is really just telling about the people who live here in North Florida and how willing they are to just reach that hand out to help their neighbors. Here comes a storm again. Somebody needs help again. And there they are again.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Regan McCarthy, Adrian Andrews, WFSU News Team. Thank you both for heading out and telling us what happened out there with Debbie.
Thanks, right, Gina.
Thank you.
That was WFSU's Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Adrian Andrews talking about the Big Bend impact of Hurricane Debbie earlier this week. Florida A&M University, the state's only public historically black institution, is addressing concerns regarding its search for a new president, low passing rates on professional licensure exams, and a fraudulent donation made by a suspicious donor. Adrian Andrews has more on that.
FAMU's Board of Trustees recently held a two-day retreat to try and answer questions and give updates on the condition of the school. The first agenda item pertained to FAMU's presidential search. The Board of Trustees brought in an interim president last month. FAMU's Board Chair Kristen Harper says before beginning the search for a new president, trustees first need to establish the selection process.
We will identify and prioritize what's most important to this board as it relates to what the university needs and therefore what the requirements are for the president.
FAMU's board hopes to have named a new university president by the summer of 2025. Former President Larry Robinson stepped down last month amid a fake donation scandal to the school. The gift, a $237 million donation, was recently declared fraudulent after an independent investigation.
This is a transformative gift to this institution. We can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
That was Robinson at the time the gift was announced. The state hired investigator Michael McCaughlin to look into the donation. He determined the gift and the donor to be fraudulent. It came in the form of private shares in the donor's company, which he alone valued. Furthermore, McLaughlin explained that those private shares were never properly transferred to the university.
The drivers behind why this gift was accepted were leadership involvement and influence, the secrecy and non-disclosure, truncated timeline due to the commencement ceremony, and then lack of due diligence and understanding of private stock.
A 15-member search committee will vet FAMU's next president. FAMU's Harper says that group will be made up of members from the trustee board, university faculty, and student body.
The search committee is responsible for submitting more than two qualified applicants to the board, selected by a majority vote.
Harper says she's looking for presidential candidates who possess certain traits like administrative experience, political capital, and a focus on student success. The search comes as some FAMU students are also underperforming when it comes to passing their licensure exams on the first try. FAMU's pharmacy, nursing, and law school students have underperformed in recent years, falling below state-approved benchmarks. Interim President Timothy Beard says he hopes with his leadership, the university can turn things around.
Given today's competitive academic environment that we're in within SUS, the goalposts will keep moving back.
Before joining FAMU, Beard led Pasco Hernando State College's nursing program to a perfect pass rate on the licensure exam. Beard looks to mimic that success at Florida A&M by implementing mandatory tutoring sessions, practice exams, and other student support measures to help bolster scores.
We've got to be courageous enough to put the resources in pre-collegiate programs.
Trustees will hold more discussions on the presidential search and implement checks and balances for those tasked with overseeing donations. These discussions will be held in September at the next Board of Trustees meeting. I'm Adrian Andrews.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, it's been a summer of frequent heat advisories around Florida. When we think about people who have to work in this heat, like farmers or construction workers, that's a group that doesn't often make the list, those who work on food trucks. Kayla Kissel reports that despite high temperatures inside the trucks and the health risks that come with that, some workers say their passion outweighs the heat.
In Orlando's Milk District, food trucks gather weekly, a definite draw for hungry and hot people. Those two things combined with the fact that it just rained and the air is thick with the Florida humidity mean the pressure and the heat are on for the people working on these food trucks, where they are not just cooking up dishes, but themselves.
With a full board of tickets and the sun out, it can become pretty intense.
That's Elliot Hillis, one of the owners of Red Panda Noodles. He says he couldn't afford a pricey brick-and-mortar restaurant, so he went with the food truck to keep the dream alive. But he says there are some drawbacks. Inside his truck, it's hot. He says on occasion, temperatures inside have gotten up to 180 degrees.
That heat grabs a hold of your lungs, almost like you're in a sauna. But if you try to gasp and get air in, it's just going to punch you straight in the lungs.
Hillis says now, after almost 2 years with the truck, he and his cooks have learned a few tricks to cool themselves down from the sizzling high heat.
What you do is you kind of kneel down for a second, and it's much, much cooler, like below waist level. And then you take a few breaths and you get back to the fray.
Hillis says they make it work, but the heat can be a real issue. While we don't usually think about food truck workers and their exposure to heat like other people who work outdoors, food truck workers are also at risk of heat-related illness. That's according to Thomas Clinton. He's a professor in the College of Health and Human Performance at the University of Florida.
There's lots of levels of heat stress. One of the most common ones that those people would experience is heat exhaustion. Because of the central nervous system effects, people start making mistakes. They'll fall off a scaffolding or they'll cut their finger. They just don't have as much control in terms of their motor function.
Clinton says there's a risk of long-term effects like kidney failure or neurological issues. Still, chefs like Hillis say they're willing to suffer for their craft.
I've had a few situations on the truck where I didn't know if I was going to pass out or not. Like, I need to be able to make it through this next few minutes. So when you get done with that and you didn't crash and you didn't die, you're like, wow, all right, whew, okay. You appreciate life more. Like, the air tastes sweeter. I don't know. Is there another way to get that kind of drug in you?
Hillis says that for him, cooking is about his love for food, but also human connection. His truck allows him to bring that food he loves to communities and people who appreciate it.
I had this woman who, her parents escaped communist China for Taiwan when the exile happened. She said, oh, you do yopo cha mian? And I said, yeah. And she said, you know how to do it right? And I'm like, I think so. And she's like, all right, give me some.
And when he asked her how it was, he said the tears in her eyes told a story that she went on to share.
She told me about her dad. He died young. And he made yopo cha mian for her. Her connection to this specific noodle is to her father. And she got to see it again. She got to feel it again, what it's like.
Being able to make that connection outweighs the heat, even with the risk of short-term or long-term health problems.
I feel like my life is better for having been a cook. That being said, I've most certainly shortened my life or damaged my body in ways that are irreparable because of the act of cooking. We're all going to die. You know what I mean? We don't like to think about it. But if I can spend my time doing something that people enjoy and I enjoy, you know, if I have to die a little younger, then I say that I've lived a good life so far.
Have a good one. Enjoy.
I'm Kayla Kissel in Orlando.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Kerry Sheridan, and Kayla Kissel. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.